In part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Knowing what's right, that's one thing. It's important, but it's only part of the equation. Carrying through on what you know to be right, that's also very important. And on the program today, we're going to talk with Al Genie. He's a professor of philosophy at Loyola of Chicago, where he teaches in the philosophy department and in the School of Business. The co-author, author, or editor of a number of books, his latest is a book about ethics for the general reader. The title, Why It's Hard to Be Good. Professor Genie says in this book that he thinks the central problem of ethics today is not a lack of moral reasoning or moral imagination, but rather a lack of moral engagement. He goes on to say that we are privately, in his words, emotionally and ethically withdrawn, unappreciative, and unempathetic to the wants, needs, and desires of others. Strong words. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments about ethics, about the good life. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Al Genie is the Associate Editor of Business Ethics Quarterly, the Journal for the Society of Business Ethics. His previous books include My Job, Myself, Work in the Creation of the Modern Individual, and The Importance of Being Lazy. We spoke with him about the latter book a couple of years ago here on the program. Those two books and his latest, Why It's Hard to Be Good, are published by Routledge. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Genie, good to talk with you again.
Good to be back with you again.
Strong words, a lack of moral engagement, emotionally and ethically withdrawn.
Are they really strong words, or is it just an inadvertent apt description of what happens in our lives? I've been teaching philosophy longer and teaching business and business ethics, or ethics and business ethics, more years than I care to admit than public airwaves. And I think philosophers look for the big issues, the big causes, and, to explain human motivation and human behavior. But the more I taught it, the more I thought about it, I think it's the little stuff. I think the reality is that ethics is always a singular activity. Even in a public ethical act always starts as an individual, and perhaps in a public setting. And I think the real issue is not some sort of diabolical personality types or rampant evil or ontological evil, this, you know, the dark force out there. I think it's simple. I think it's really about the inability to stand outside of the shadow of self. And that's the metaphor I keep pounding in the text. To stand outside the shadow of our own needs, of our own interests, of our own lives, of our own concerns. To stand outside of us long enough to recognize other.
Hmm. You also use this phrase, the emotional fortress of self.
Yeah.
It's tough to break out of this fortress.
It really is, and I think I chose the phrase fortress there specifically. I think we create it. I think we create it through carelessness. Not caring about others, and I think that's very often studied and not just inadvertent or accidental. I think we create it out of callousness. We build these stones for this fortress that we actually make ourselves, and I like that term, more callous, thicker skinned to the cries and needs of others. We create a certain studied apathy on our part. You know, we see so much. I always explain with my students, when I get off the L, between hitting the L stop and my office, I usually count about 16 beggars, street people, trying to make a living, trying to get by. And I always suggest that getting to my office costs me a donut, a cup of coffee, and a couple bucks, because you just can't walk by everyone. You feel too badly. But it's easy. After a while, most of us do walk by, because there'll always be another beggar. There'll always be someone else there. And finally, I think, besides apathy, we just develop this hardcore indifference to others. Because we are urban creatures, because there are so many others around us, you can't dwell on it. And in some sense, I want to say in defense of ourselves, it's a sanitive device. But in another sense, it's a device of not caring, of not letting anyone in, of isolating and insulating ourselves from others.
Do you think we too easily say, I can't do anything about that?
Yeah, I think it is easy to say that. I really can't do anything about that. I mean, I can't make this poor people, a poor person, I can't give this poor person a job. I can't relieve the poverty in the nation. I'm not responsible for the fact that, you know, inflation has hit so many people and there are more people homeless. But I think ethics is always a personal act. I mean, one of the things that I'm always preaching to my students is ethics is not simply a study. It's not simply some abstraction. It's about what one individual does to another. So if that's true, you may not be able to relieve the social problem of poverty, but you might be able to put $2 in that person's hand for a small meal at a McDonald's if you could put together a couple other bucks from someone else's hand. On the other hand, I don't want to say, you know, we have to walk down the street emptying our pockets to everyone we see, but what I think in our contemporary modern life, between our televisions, our Walkmans, our video games, our the Internet, more and more we cocoon ourselves, protect ourselves from others because of this bombardment of others. And that makes sense. What doesn't make sense is to do that in every situation and not be concerned about others.
Hmm. You write in this book that you see ethics as primarily a communal, collective enterprise. So
yeah.
if we're cocooned off from one another, where are we?
Yeah, we don't worry about community. I think it's John Dewey was right, the famous American philosopher. You know, we have made a fetish out of the cult of rugged individualism and the pursuit of happiness, and we're worried about me, myself, and I. And I think that's a downside of the real virtue and value of a democracy, the rights of the individual, when they become exclusively pursued, you know, set up this isolationism in regard to the rights of the individual. And I think we have to remember that all personal rights, all private rights, in fact, exist within the context of a larger community. So when Chief Justice, I'm blanking on his name right now, forgive me.
Roberts.
In your moment, once said, you know, the right of freedom of speech does not entail the right to yell fire in a crowded auditorium. And I think that our rights always exist in this collective pool of other rights. And so when we simply isolate ourselves and worry about me, myself, and I think we diminish ourselves and diminish the rights of others along the way.
If we were more engaged, if we were living an examined life as individuals and collectively, what do you think the implications would be for us?
This is connected to your previous question as well. This notion of private rights, as I think, very limited. When I suggest that ethics is a communal obligation, when Robinson Crusoe found himself stranded, marooned on this small atoll on the Pacific side of South America, he lived in an ethically neutral universe. All the mangoes, all the papayas, everything his heart desires was available to him on that island because he was there alone. But the minute he found Friday's footprints that Friday morning on the beach, and hence called the black slave Friday, he was in a different universe. And the minute they found pirates bearing gold and each other on the beach, the universe then multiplied again. Now there was this universe of others, and there was some obligation to others and responsibilities in regard to oneself. And I think it that ethics is always this notion of when you claim a right, you have to allow that right in others. And I think that social policy is diminished when we in our society are only worried about ourselves. And I want to suggest, although I didn't talk enough about this in this text, that one of the main reasons for that is, I think our system, our economic system, has perpetuated this notion of private consumerism as our real God and religion and economic theory in the society. And private consumerism is only about that which I consume, not what others consume.
Yeah. And we have so many choices.
So many choices. Indeed, an astute reader, I will send you an A for the first part of the exam so far. I do think, you know, that we're worn down by the banalities. We're not, again, not it's not that the devil made me do it, as Flip Wilson used to always say, and Sammy Davis Jr. would suggest. You know, no, it's not the devil. It's one's own devils. It's one's own, you know, inner self saying, do this or don't do that. And then it's also the pace and rate and volume of our modern lives. This last week, I had a wonderful experience, an absolutely wonderful week by anyone's standards. I was in San Francisco, California, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, on book signings and presentations. I was in San Francisco for one day, in New York for 2 days, and one whole day, back and there and back on one day to Chicago, to get on a plane the next day for New York, to come back and drive out through the rainstorms to Fort Wayne, et cetera, et cetera. It was too much. Every one of those experiences were little jewels that I relish. Put them all together, and it wears you down and wears you out, that you could maybe hear in my voice. Hmm. We're always too busy. When we're in, it's what my mother said to me years ago. It's amazing how one's mother gains in wisdom the longer you live. When your mouth is in gear, your brain isn't. And we're always busy and wonder when we can make good choices.
Yeah. Well, the last time we spoke about the importance of leisure.
Yeah.
And I believe we touched on this subject, the need for time for reflection and rejuvenation.
Right. And when you even think of the word recreate, it, you know, I hate to this basic etymology here, but it's really recreate, to redefine, to reassess, to reestablish self. Recreation is not just play; it's rest and rehabilitation. And I think when we're always busy, we don't have time for reflection. That's why athletes and officers are trained to make snap decisions even under duress, no matter what's happening. Kind of tattooed in one's brain, this is the order and drill when X, Y, or Z occurs. Because in the moment, reason is not going to occur. You know, you're not necessarily going to do the rational thing. But if you're sufficiently trained, you might make the correct move and do the right thing. But I think in our private lives, when we're always busy, when we're always over-engaged, when every day is what I call the everyday-thon, you know, this endurance event, the Olympic endurance event, when you get up in the morning and the alarm is off at 5:45 and you don't return to that bed again until 11:15, I think the problematic is fatigue makes cowards and fools of us all. And the problematic is when you're handling 10 things at once, I'm not sure if you can do any one thing that well.
Hmm. Do you think we love the buzz of it, or do you think we just don't know how to get out of it?
Well, My family, my wife, and my students think I am the curmudgeon of curmudgeons in the best of senses, that I would probably be more comfortable on a horse and with smoke signals. And I guess I am, because it slows down the pace of life. Think of this. In 1985, there were less than 300,000 cell phones in America. As of last month, there was 180 million. And we've now gotten used to having private, personal conversations in public. And we've also gotten used to blotting them out if we possibly can, except when they're sitting next to us on a train. And we've changed the pace of our lives. We are constantly connected. Every time a plane lands now, the first thing that happens is not the safety belt being clicked off, it's the phone being snapped on for people to call. At night in my graduate course, people don't, at the break, stand around and talk to each other and mull about the issues we were discussing in class. They stand back-to-back on their cell phones talking to somebody else. And so I think the pace of our life has, you know, really, really changed. And the input of our life has really, really changed, which makes it difficult to be reflective. Students will say, I can multitask. And I say, no, you can't. Say, no, I can watch television or listen to music and read and concentrate just as well. I'm saying, you're used to doing both, but I'm not sure you do service to either one by doing both.
What is the great allure of the cell phone?
You know, it's still part of your last question. It's this, we're used to the buzz.
Yeah.
We want to be connected. It's like the busiest of business persons will say to you, you know, let's do lunch. Can you pencil me in for August the 5th? You know, that our status, our prestige is because we're so vital and vibrant that we're so busy that we can't possibly get together for weeks and weeks and weeks. I think the buzz of the activity means, in being busy, I am. In being overstimulated, I am, even if there's a negative connotation. And so, like the accumulation of stuff, in the accumulation of tasks, is a reflection of our prowess and success in the world.
Hmm. It is interesting, though, that there is something. I don't want to totally disrespect the cell phone because it is an act of connection.
Yes, it is an act. But, you know, nor do I want to. Here's the example, and you got to be very careful on this one. I think morphine is a good thing.
If you're in pain.
If you're in pain. I think cocaine is a bad thing. As an escape mechanism, et cetera, et cetera. I think I love the Italian word for it, telefonini, the little bitty phone, can be a lifesaver, can be a way to extricate oneself from difficult situations, can be a way to be connected when something isn't available, to have a lifeline to kids, et cetera, et cetera. I know on that trip down to Fort Wayne yesterday and the storms are coming back in the storms, I personally don't own a cell phone. By the way, I have a black and white television, and I'm listening to you on a radio that's got tubes in it, just to show you I am a curmudgeon. But I don't have one, but I could have used one, and I was cursing the fact that I didn't have one at that moment, although I don't want to be burdened with them. I think that many of the devices of our society are wonderful, wonderful things. Computers, how can you argue that a computer isn't an asset and a vital tool to our lives? On the other hand, you know, we're now saying that under the college age, children are putting in 8.2 hours a day on computers, television, cell phones, iPods, you know, video games, et cetera, et cetera. One wonders if that isn't excessive.
Mm. A lot of screen time.
Yeah, a lot of screen time. And let me suggest this from just an academic point of view. When I was a young man, right after Gutenberg had to come out with his new invention, if you remember, to put together a bibliography was a major part of your paper. In other words, you wrote a 15-page paper, and if you could turn in a 10-page bibliography, everybody wondered at that, you know, that you spent so much time in the stacks and that you had done this. And that was, and you could get tenure as a professor if you could put together a living bibliography of, you know, all the works written about John Dewey, for example. In fact, I'm looking at said book right now that I bought 30 years ago. Now, in a nanosecond, John Dewey hit, you know, enter, articles written on. Boom, they're there. That's not wisdom. That's collecting. Wisdom begins then with reading some of those articles. And so, you know, I think that the computer gives us a snapshot and opportunities to develop knowledge, but it doesn't produce knowledge in and of itself.
Mm. Makes making the footnotes a whole lot easier.
Yeah, oh, it does, and that's what I mean. What a wonderful thing. You don't have to spend time looking for the book. You could get the book. You don't even have to go to the library. You could download the article. That's the beauty and wisdom of it all. But you still have to read the stuff.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking in terms of I grew up with the typewriter.
Oh, yes.
And making those footnotes at the bottom of the page with the typewriter was a killer.
It was a killer. In fact, I remember...
What a waste of time.
What a waste of time. And to all... And what the computer has done is certainly made the best typewriter in the world. You know, you could just save that file, go to another file, do it again, repaginate it, renumber it. When I got my PhD, you could not, and it was not just my university. I think it was standard operating procedures in universities. You could have no typos in the paper, and you could have no use of whiteout. So So if a paper was edited, you know, your dissertation director said, oh, this is all great except for, you know, I don't like reading page three, but just take that out. That's done. It meant retyping the whole thing again. Or any mistake meant you had to begin again. Now, how many mistakes do you find? Fine, I'll just print out another copy. Mm-hmm. So it has made life richer, easier. And I think that, as in most things in life, as a student of philosophy, and by no means do I want to claim to be a philosopher, especially now that I teach primarily in the School of Business and Business Ethics, there's two sides to every issue. Seriously, two, you know, a benefit and a downside to every issue is, and wisdom, you try to get the best of one and avoid the latter.
Hmm. Al Genie is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Why It's Hard to Be Good. He is a professor of philosophy at Loyola of Chicago, where he teaches in the philosophy department and in the School of Business. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign. Good afternoon. Line four, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I'm enjoying the conversation today. I feel I'm kind of betraying a trust here, actually calling you from a cell phone, so please forgive me. I just had a comment, and I'll ring off. But I'm 50, and I've got a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and you were talking about, you know, the cell phone and the way our life has changed. And I find it in my children, it's this instantaneous, you know, if we can do it instantly, why not? I want it now, give it to me now, what's the point of waiting, so on and so forth. And this is a little far afield, but I can remember being very interested in the Winter Olympics. And I could not, for the life of me, get my kids to watch the Winter Olympics. And I guess they made some story about how low the ratings were. And, I don't know if it's because the kids have, access to everything right away, but there's no, it wasn't exciting. It wasn't new. It was, you know, when I was a kid, the Olympics, holy cow, you know, it was once every 4 years. And now it's a blasé. It's complacency. And, anyway, I'd be interested in your comments and joining the show. Thank you.
Well, I think our caller has brought up really two kind of critical points. His children are clearly more intellectually savvy than maybe he is. Certainly my children, and who are now adults, were, you know, they never took a course on a computer. They just learned how to use a computer. It's almost natural. I had to take a course. Here is the button. Turn this on. Wait for the humming to stop. Then hit this. You know, enter, so on and so forth. Literally had to take steps. It became natural. And I also find it interesting that my children never took a course in typing, and they're whiz-bang typists, mm-hmm. because that was part of the extension of the computer. But it's this immediacy. And I think this immediacy is wonderful. Help, Dad, I'm in trouble. The car's broken down. I've got a flat tire. It's, you know, it's 11 o'clock at night. Come and get me, kind of thing. But I think the speed and pace of our lives, and I talk about that in the book on change and the pace of change, it's not just change, it's the rate of change. And I think what we've created in our children and our grandchildren, in my case, is this immediacy, that everything is now. And they expect life to always be faster and better. And that's the part of the addiction of the buzz. And the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. That was good, now what? I'm finding out with my undergraduates that they think a 15-week course is forever. You know, I'm not going to take poetry, too. I did 15 weeks of poetry. I've covered it all. I'm just throwing out of class right now. And so I think that we've changed the rate of time and absorption. And the other thing is, given our new media technology, which is wondrous, let me not sound like Galileo Galilei and, you know, wanting quill pens and parchments only. It's wonderful and wondrous. But the Olympics, to our children, it can't compete with the other kind of stimuli that it's available to them. It's like books. Remember the old Willie Nelson song, Mama, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys? Well, from my point of view as an academic, Mama, Don't Let Your Baby Grow Up to Be Writers, because, you know, it's a dying breed. And who reads books? Even though bookstores are this growing industry, it's a very strange, paradoxical situation. And I think what we've created in our children and created in the electronic age is give me the next thing now syndrome. I've done this, done that, now what's next? And I'm wondering about leisure. I'm wondering about rest. I'm wondering about, you know, thoughtfulness. I'm wondering about the old Socratic question of the unexamined life. It doesn't happen in 30 seconds. It's a process, not simply an event.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Al Genie.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question, or a comment, I guess, for Professor Genie. You've somewhat deviated from it in this last 10 minutes, but the first part of your talk, you concentrated on the selfishness, concentrated on the individual at the expense of and ignoring of others. And while I think that is accurate for some people, I don't sense that you appreciate that we can hold on to that notion of the importance of self, but what we have to realize it oftentimes involves is an expanded notion of self. It's not an individual solely. That individual all of a sudden is thinking solely in terms of the family or the neighborhood or the business or the church or my immediate friend circles. And so it's that larger sense of self which is given priority over all others, but it's not, it's very seldom just one individual. It's a larger notion of self, and it comes up to the point of nations. America is the big self, and everyone else, the hell with them. So our political party and anything that's other than our political party is treated as other, and ourself is identical to our political party. So I see, I sense that a need to appreciate expanded notion of self. It still causes the same problems, and that is there is a whole group, a whole reality that's being ignored. But it's not because one individual is placing herself or himself above all else. That one individual has an expanded notion of who they are.
Yeah, yeah. I think we have no dissonance between my theory and yours, and I think you said it more eloquently than myself and expanded the notion. I think you're, I think it's a poverty of language between us right now that is separating us, but not the concept. I agree with you. This notion of self is larger self, and certainly the isolation of self sometimes means you, in the Italian phrase, you know, the Sopranos are back on, everything's okay as long as you don't treat, you know, members of your family bad. Sangue di mia sangue.
Exactly.
You could treat others differently, but not your family.
Exactly.
And I think you're right, and I think we've developed enough psychology of social science now, or the psychoanalysis of social science, that America does think of itself, you know, all others not like us are other, and therefore we can think of them differently. And I think that when we're talking about isolation of self, I mean that also in a social, political context as well. I think that, frankly, giving away my politics and my purview right now on the war, I think this has been an arrogant, narcissistic adventure in which the Americans thought they were right, and even when they were wrong, the American foreign policy thought it was right, and even when it was wrong, it refused to admit the mistake and is continuing on. So I think this gentleman has correctly and aptly expanded my argument.
And my only comment then was that I wish you had said it early on when you were saying that, because it did sound as if it was a single person's.
Well, I think it starts with a single person.
Oh, yes.
And that I'm going to hold on to.
Oh,
I
yes.
think it starts. But then you
but
learn how to be
the
single person in regard to your group,
yes,
single
right.
person in regard to your family,
exactly.
in regard to your political party.
Right.
For example, the real embarrassment in Congress right now is when you're elected president, it's not the loyal opposition. It's the opposition who now wants to get you out. And I think that certainly was demonstrated in how the Republicans dealt with Mr. Clinton and how the Democrats are now trying to deal with Mr. Bush. There isn't this notion of we have different opinions on the same basic values. How can we best work together to take care of all of our constituencies? It's us against them. And
yes.
I think that's an adversarial
yes.
and negative
I agree.
Position.
I agree.
Thank you
very
sir.
Much.
Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Al Jeanne is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the program. His latest book is Why It's Hard to Be Good. What questions are useful to ask, Professor Jeanne, in an examination of one's self in terms of examining one's life?
Well, God, the hardest questions in the world, right? Was that included in the book? Is this going to be on the exam? I think that, you know, I think we've forgotten the Socratic admonition. Part of this book is really about that the goal of life is not simply to live well and to be successful, but to live well with others and do no harm. And that there's no such thing as simply personal well-being. It has to be personal well-being in regard to others. And I think that if Socrates is right, the beginnings of wisdom is, you know, the examine life. I think the examine life really means, who am I and am I alone? And the immediate answer to that is no. Look around. We're not alone. I mean, and I remember that in the 60s, people wanted to go off to Colorado and, you know, do organic drugs and or non-organic, do organic drugs. That was a Freudian slip. Non-organic, you know, foods and vegetables and have the organic drugs, perhaps, and to live alone, to live in isolation. But that's not really real. We all live in the context of others. We all have support mechanisms and support groups. We don't have to be always face-to-face. We don't have to be a member of a team always. But we are contextual people. We are not herd animals. We are, by definition, communal animals. And I think once you accept that, once you accept and one can transcend this issue that Ernest Becker says we can't transcend always, this selfish notion of narcissism, that we have to recognize others. It's not even an option. And of course what Becker means by this selfish notion of narcissism is the old myth of Narcissus, who, you know, the young, beautiful boy who others loved and treated him to return the love, and he would not. And so the gods punished him by letting him fall in love with his image in a pool of water. And he says to the image somewhere along the way, now I know the pain I have suffered unto others by the pain you are giving me by not returning the love that I want to offer you. And then you remember the end of that myth. There are a couple of variations on it, that he simply expired next to that pool of water waiting for his lover to return, or drowned himself in the pool of water, seeking out the face of his lover. But the gods took pity on him because he was so beautiful and created this flower that has this very pungent odor in early spring to attract the bees, of course, and then quickly dies because of its delicacy and beauty. I think we are building little narcissists in our society. We do that in our consumerism, in our commercialism, in our sense of ownership, and the sense of personal privileges, personal entitlements. And I think that that breeds a system that doesn't allow us to think in larger terms. And so I think we have to begin by asking, am I really the solitary soldier? And I think the answer is no. You know, Freud, you really asked the ultimate question. Freud was right when he said, the hardest thing we can do in our lives is be honest with ourselves and be carefully self-examine ourselves. Because if we do so, then the next logical step is to do something about those things that we do not like and find offensive. And that's the hardest thing in the world to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with a couple of more listeners. Next, we go to Champaign Line 1. Hello.
Hi. I just have a quick comment question. It seems as if we address others as almost a negative of whatever you're viewing. And it seems like the people that I know that I look up to in the sense of I think that's a good person or that person's doing good things, it's almost like they have a different perspective on the others, so to speak, in the way that they think of the people as individuals and each of them as their own self. You know, it's like when I view myself and reflect, they are doing the same thing. Let's try to put myself in their shoes.
Right. And no, I think, again, here's the poverty of language, and forgive me, and the other gentleman pointed this up as well. What I mean by recognizing others means that others have rights and others are real, exactly the way you are enunciating it.
Yeah, I think what you said is very accurate and to the point, but I just see that most people, when we self-reflect mm-hmm. upon, you know, what could I do better tomorrow or whatever, we view others as so separated from us
right.
that we can't view ourselves correctly, because I think what we've sort of hit at is when we want to reflect, it's not necessarily how we see our lives, but we have to try to inference what we are seeing through other people's eyes.
You're right on point, and I think, again, the poverty of language here, I couldn't say it better, and you said it better than I possibly could muster up. And when we use other, by the way, for example, in aggression theories, and what the gentleman was referring to before, the last caller was referring to, you know, all those not like me are other. That's the negative. And those others have no rights. And, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Yeah.
Your position is, I think, the more correct ethical position. Others do have rights. And my rights in abutting others have to be addressed as well. It's always, there's no such thing as a self. I think this is what we're both saying. There's no such thing as self. It's always self in conjunction with others. Think of the yin-yang diagram, the Chinese, two sides that you could make a distinction of, but simply don't exist separately. There's no such thing as a person, a monkey, and there's always in this other context. And so I think yours is the more positive approach, and that's the point that I mean, that recognizing others doesn't see others as barriers, or enemies or adversaries, but rather others as responsible individuals or with rights that have to be honored as well.
Yeah, so now my question, could you discuss your view on how a person could view another person's actions or beliefs as being wrong, but still condone a respect, and how might we go around in the world? We have self-evaluated and say, we believe this is wrong. So how do we, and we see someone do that act that's wrong, how do we distinguish and how do we behave ethically in that situation? And I'll just listen to what you have to say about that.
You know, it's always a pleasure to be on your show and to listen to your show when I occasionally drive downstate. And your questioners and listeners always ask the most difficult questions. Let me just try. I think for me, I'm going to take some refuge in Immanuel Kant. That you can't just look at an action and see what the action produced. You can't just look at a behavior and look at the behavior produced. You have to look at the moral agent and the reason or the intention of the action. And so for me, you have to look at the intention of the actor. That is, I could be very, very mad at my doctor for a bad diagnosis, but I want to look at his intention. Was his diagnosis out of ignorance, out of sloth, out of indifference, out of mismanagement, not being correctly prepared, or was it an honest mistake and he, confused a symptom to be something else and made a judgment call, but his attempt was really to help you? I think you have to look at the intentions of individuals. I happened to be reading a war novel this last week about Vietnam, and actually it was a memoir, and about the war. American soldiers going back to Vietnam right now and meeting Vietnamese soldiers and meeting in friendship. Now, this has been happening in regard to World War II soldiers and so on and so forth. And meeting in some sort of fellowship and saying, I still disagree with what you did or the way you operated, but your intentions were honorable. You were trying to defend your nation as well. To see the film Munich, which I did not like for theatrical reasons, not for its ideology, was to watch Spielberg try to say everyone in that operation was trying to be a patriot. But somebody got, lots of people got hurt along the way. I think you have to look at intentions. It doesn't often make an action or a negative result more palatable, but at least you understand where it came from.
Let's talk with another listener. Listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
This is a very interesting conversation, and as one of the few Native Americans in this community, I'm an other in my own land. Mm-hmm. You talk about intention, and one other person was talking about trying to understand and respect a person, even though they disagreed with them. And one of the things that's in this community is the flagship University of Illinois using a stereotype race-based mascot who many people adore and actually live their life around the trappings of that particular sport. And in fact, there are some goings-on behind the scene regarding the Board of Trustees in which they are trying to what I would call Indians with a small I in trying to support the continuation of this mascot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where, you know, I don't know what the morals are of these people. But you talk about narcissism, you talk about people doing things for themselves and not regarding the feelings and rights of others. There was even an article, a little, a columnist in one of the, in the local school paper who talked about why couldn't he have permission to use the N-word or words like gay, queer, retard, etc. And he was, I don't know, I was appalled that a person would want to be able to have permission to be unkind. Now, I can understand a group of guys sitting around drinking and belching beer and deciding they want to talk and use those kind of terms. But, you know, I have a nephew who is severely retarded, and I wouldn't want anybody to be talking around me, around his parents, using those terms. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wonder, in this particular community, the powers that be are working very hard and assiduously trying to get permission from, I guess I'd call them Indian players, to try to get them to say it's okay to have a mascot, which I don't believe they should have.
Well, here's where
very demeaning.
Let me focus on the word intention here. Here's where the word intention really comes to bear. You may not always like the outcome of someone's intentions, but you want to ask their intentions. And you're talking about forgiveness later down the field, perhaps. Bad pun, talking about this. But what's the intention of a certain action? And the way I see it right now, as from a distance, and I must tell you, I'm a mixed mind about it. For example, I think, as an Italian-American, it took me 3 years before I could watch The Sopranos. I did not want just more kind of slanderous allegations that all Italian-Americans are da-da-da-da-da. It took me a long time to become a real follower of The Godfather and to enjoy the beauty of the films until I decided that they were morality plays and not necessarily about Italians, but really a larger kind of mythic melodrama about good and evil and right and wrong and responsibilities. And clearly, Mr. Chasen, in regard to The Sopranos, is not advocating Tony Soprano's lifestyle. He's saying, you know, he's a fool and a braggart and a bully. But, you know, the rights of people to define themselves and be known known in a certain way, I think you're absolutely right, and people's individual and collective rights have to be, you know, I don't like to be called a Dago, except by fellow Italian-Americans who are teasing me. I don't like that word. And
you don't necessarily like them. They could tease you in other ways, couldn't they?
Right. I mean, so, but having said this, you know, I have to be very careful. I, for example, think the Cleveland Indian logo is absolutely offensive to me, and I think is racistly insulting. The large nose, the bulging eyes, I find it terribly insulting.
Before you go on, this train of thought, you said offensive to me.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find interesting is that people sometimes speak for me and say
I think
that
it's offensive to anyone of that ethnic group. Sorry. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I'm offended to as well as a member, you know, I would want my subspecies or my subgroup, my niche group to be so characterized either. Again, the poverty of language. I think that I totally understand the argument that cartoonish figure is not respectful of a group of people who are self-designated.
I feel, you know, that our particular Chief Illiniwek is an affront on many ways. And for one thing, no chief who gets that honor by good deeds and courage, et cetera, would never be put in a halftime entertainment for the dominant society. And just that alone, and the idea that that would be okay, and people working so hard against something that is on its face and well down to the ground is not right.
Well, I totally understand. You know, the focus and the central core of your argument. I totally understand it. I have to be totally honest with you. I'm really conflicted on the issue myself. I don't see it. I don't see Chief Lionel personally, and I have, this is the first time I've said this out loud, as offensive. I thought it was a celebration of American Native American strength.
That's what people say.
Okay, I'm just trying to get that out right now. But I totally understand your offense, and I think what we've got is a rights conflict on this issue.
Well,
I have rights.
I don't agree with that, because I remember somebody being extolled as an excellent person because they freed their slaves. But the idea that you had that power to free somebody in the first place is a
I understand
that,
but there's also the evolution
wrong.
Of thought. I mean, you're quite right. You know, this nation, one nation under God, indivisible, so on and so forth, is not one nation under God, not under the same God, and not indivisible. We've had a civil war, and Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, and so did Washington, and that was part of the intellectual nature of